What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! Alice in Wonderland is a celebrated Lewis Carroll novel made only more popular by Disney's animated adaptation in the 1950s. In the story, Alice experiences strange phenomena such as feeling herself grow taller and shorter and enduring psychedelic scenes. A few years after the film was released, a term was coined for certain symptoms dubbed Alice in Wonderland syndrome, in which distortions of vision occurred. One such symptom dominant in the syndrome was chloropsia, a disorder of vision where objects appear with a green tint. In 1996, Long Island band Vision of Disorder would sign to Roadrunner Records via a short-lived imprint, Super Soul, and release their debut album. The cover would become an image that resonated throughout their career as they felt themselves grow larger as a band. A green drip. This week on Meep Meep, Season 3 continues with the 25th anniversary of the self-titled album, Vision of Disorder. Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influence. Let's roll! What up, meepsters? And this week we got a corker for you. Vision of Disorder's self-titled debut album, Vision of Disorder, aka The Green Drip. We'll be speaking with VOD and Blood Simple riff ruler Mike Kennedy, but first, my fellow Aries Jeremy Bolm of Touche Amore fame was kind enough to tell me about Vision of Disorder's early influence on him as a fan of heavy music. Vision of Disorder's first album comes out in 1996 on Roadrunner. So was this album the first album that you heard, or did you... For me, I personally heard Imprint first before I heard self-titled. Someone had showed it to me because they were like, yo, Phil Anselmo is on this song with this guy, and they both busted their eye blood vessels screaming, trying to outdo each other. You gotta hear this band. And I was like, yeah, I definitely gotta hear that band. So then I went backwards and heard self-titled from there. But was this your first exposure to Vision of Disorder?
It was, yeah. I was already like a pretty big metal kid in 90, because this is 96, right? When that record came out. So yeah, I would say I think I got it in like 97, I would say. Before we started recording, I was telling you about this record store up the street from me called DB Cooper's, which always just had used CDs. I grew up in Burbank, which is the media city capital of the world. So like all the interns would basically just like steal, you know, boxes of CDs of like promos and sell them to all the local record stores in the area. So like, you know, anytime I'd go in there, there'd probably be a stack of all the newest releases or old releases or whatever from all of these labels, Roadrunner to like Warner Brothers to Sony to whatever. So I would often find all these CDs for like $4.99, $5.99, because it was owned by these really old guys who genuinely did not know what they had or cared. They were just like, you know, it was just product in their store. So they didn't know what stuff was worth or whatever. So anything that I saw in there that I found in there that had a Roadrunner Records logo on the back, I would just buy. You know, I'd be like, whatever, it's on Roadrunner. It's got to be good. You know, and sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it was. So I bought that CD not knowing anything about it other than just what a strange album cover. So I got it and I listened to it and I was like, just instantly down. Like I was so like, you know, I don't know that I was able to necessarily differentiate between, you know, what made that record so much different than maybe the Fear Factories or the Sepulturas or anything like that, other than just like, oh, the vocals sound different. Oh, like there's kind of like a funky bass line here and there and like things like that. But I remember I really, really liked it. And it kind of stayed with me for a long time. And I remember when Imprint was coming out, I believe it was just like a year later, it was 98, and actually noticing quite a big change in the overall tone of the band, where like, it's just, I look at Imprint as like such a dark, gruff record. Like I can't think of any other albums that really sound like that. Like it sounds like almost everything on it is like peaking. You know what I'm saying? Like it's like so hyper distorted and just pissed. It's one of the most angry records that I've ever heard. Whereas I feel like the first record is a lot more clean, and you can really pick out kind of every little thing that's happening in it. There's a lot of, you know, like wild tracks of, you know, like overdubs and all these different vocals on top of one another. And like, everything is very crisp. Whereas like, yeah, like Imprint sounds super blown out. So I do remember that being one of the first records from like a band that I was really attached to the first record, then heard the new record and actually noticed the change. Like, I feel like it was that. And then also Far, between Tin Cans of Strings to You and Water and Solutions, where it was like, oh, these feel sound like two almost like different bands in a way. Not as dramatic with VOD, but that's, and it's funny because D Sardi or whatever did Water and Solutions and Imprint, which is super interesting, in the same year.
The difference between self-titled and Imprint is so dramatic, not only in, like you said, like just kind of the sonic landscape, but just, you can tell that, to me, it sounds like self-titled was what they were already kind of done being, you know what I mean? Like, it almost seems like by the time that album came out, they were over that sound, because they had already done the Still EP, which a lot of those songs kind of bleed over, and that by the time they got to Imprint, it was probably what they were already in their minds working towards. It seems like a very natural progression, I will say that. It doesn't seem like jarring, yeah. Like maybe a River Runs Red to Ugly is, where it's like, oh, guys, we really loved what you were doing before, and I don't know what's going on here. But my biggest thing with self-titled too that I hear about now is that people don't like, I guess, how clean and polished it is compared to, you know, kind of their older school fans really like the rawness of the demo, or the Still EP, I should say. Still, or I guess, yeah. But to me, the polished aspect of it, which even polished is such a subjective thing, because it still sounds like gritty and angry and, mm-hmm. and aggressive. I think it brings out a lot of what makes those songs so great. You know, a song like Element, you know, that opens up, that also opens up my mind. It's just intense because of that. I can hear every instrument. I can hear every aspect of it, that I think it would be lost on the kind of production that the EP had before it.
I think you're spot on with that. I hadn't thought about what you had just said too, with how they could have been already working towards the sound of Imprint. Cause yeah, I mean, who knows? I don't even know if I know what year self-titled might've been recorded. It might've taken a while for it to eventually come out. Cause yeah, I mean, like DTO is on Still, right? And so it's Through My Eyes. Self-titled is still my favorite record from them, as much as I love Imprint. I think because of that clean production, I know every word to the self-titled record. Whereas I don't know every word to Imprint, you know, like the vocals aren't as clear on a lot of that stuff. So like, it never hooked me quite as much as the vocals in self-titled. And that's not to say I dislike Imprint. I fucking ride hard for Imprint, but like, you know, self-titled is going to always be my favorite record, just because time and place, introduction to the band. And they might've been the first band that I remember, like a first aggressive band that I remember hearing, where I felt like the person in this band is like writing about actually like deep, thoughtful, metaphoric, philosophical, all these different things, which I hadn't really heard much in the genre before. I like metal as much as the next person, or I certainly did at that time. And like, I never connected to much of it emotionally, or I couldn't really tell the difference in a vocal performance, because, you know, there's a sincerity that felt maybe lost in some of the records I liked at the same time without realizing it. But the sincerity in the vocals on these VOD records is very obvious, you know, like between moments where his voice kind of cracks or his voice sounds extremely blown out. Not a lot of people, I think, would really do that. The sincerity on these records, especially that self-titled record, is palpable.
We'll be back after a quick break. If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at RootsMusicRambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
You mentioned the lyrics and the songwriting on there. It seems like on a lot of these songs. So we got Suffer that's talking about how he kind of seems like down on the straight edge movement because they're not able to understand the suffering he's going through, the need, drugs and alcohol. And then you got Zone Zero where he hates Los Angeles. So most of this album is how he doesn't like you specifically.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard Zone Zero. I was so excited because I don't think there was any songs in my life, especially at that time. I mean, 96, I'm 13 years old, like where I was like he says Los Angeles and fucking like it, like engulfed in flames. I was like, yeah, like it's just hard as hell. And like, you know, every kid hates their hometown, wherever they're, you know, wherever they are at that point in their life. So like, I remember just being like, yeah, fuck yeah. Like it's hard as hell. And they were the first hardcore band that I ever saw live too. Like that was the first hardcore show that I specifically went to, like knowing that I was going to something different, you know what I'm saying? Like, but that was the show that also made me realize like, oh, this isn't just a metal band. Like, cause it was Buried Alive, Candiria, Scarhead, and VOD, and Buried Alive played first. And that's when I remember watching Buried Alive play with my friend, and we're just looking at the audience being like, oh, this is different. Like everybody here is terrifying. Everyone is like, I don't know what they're doing in the mosh pit. I don't know what this, you know, what at the time I didn't know what that kind of moshing was, you know. I was 13 years old, or at that point 14, I think. But the only other hardcore band that I saw was Accidental, because I actually went to go see Far at the Roxy in 98, and Snapcase did a surprise set right before they played. And that was my first time seeing a band where I was like, wait, this is different. What are all these people doing here? Like, what's happening in the crowd? But then, yeah, that VOD show was like the one I went to with like intent to see a band that was going to be different, you know? And it definitely changed my life where I was like, oh, this feels a lot more sincere. This feels a lot more, it's like, I hadn't known what it felt like to be scared at a show before, you know? And like, I think that speaks to younger people. You know, I don't know that I necessarily want to go to shows, you know, now that I'm in my late 30s where I want to feel scared at. But like as a teenager, that's like kind of a special feeling. I don't know if you can relate to that.
Yeah, definitely. The danger and the violence makes it exciting. It's that thrill of like, I don't know what's going to happen here. I know that it's going to be memorable, though. And I'm not going to forget it, whether it's because I have to go to the hospital or because I remember making it out alive and also having a good time. So I think it's that that suspense, the same reason why we love horror movies or something like that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, like, you know, going to metal shows all, you know, at that time, especially a lot of new metal shows and stuff, like all you would expect from the audience is like very drunk guys push moshing, like push pitting, or the audience pogoing, you know. It's like those were like the two things that happened. Like there really wasn't even much crowd surfing and things like that. So like seeing VOD in this like relatively small venue, like the Troubadour is like one of the most, you know, like praised, loved venues in Los Angeles, but it's only like 500 cap, so like no barrier, the whole thing. So like I remember feeling very like, oh, I don't know what's gonna happen here. Like this is definitely intense.
Thanks to Jeremy, and if you want to hear even more about his relationship with VOD, check out his podcast, the first ever podcast, where he interviews their vocalist, Tim Williams. Real cool. But I can't keep my cool when I think about how sick this Green Drip album is. And there's a moment where I prove it in this conversation with Mike Kennedy. We talk about the contrast between making the first Vision of Disorder album versus the first Blood Simple record, Ozfest, and Denim. Yeah, I mean, KSAD was, you would just listening to, well, especially Blood Simple, but Vision of Disorder, it sounds like KSAD would have been one of the first records you got into, you know what I mean?
Yeah, very much so. And actually, when we signed, here's a good Roadrunner story for you. When we signed with Roadrunner, as we were like being, I guess, groomed by Howie Abrams, who was the A&R guy at the time, he brought us in. And it's funny, they have like, everywhere you go into like rooms and there's like a band in there. It was like, you know, Dog Eat Dog's in there, Life of Agony's in there. And we walk in this other room and Max Cavalera is just sitting there and they play us Roots. And we were just like, holy shit. It's just this wall of sound. We were like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my life. And it still is, actually. It's still one of the best records in heavy metal.
Straight Hate, first of all, is named after the Roots song, I gotta imagine. And secondly, is like the cardio cheat code. Like you
Tim will never admit that he borrowed the name, but you know, probably.
So you kind of mentioned being, you know, when you're being groomed by Roadrunner with Howie Abrams, he's kind of told a story on here about signing you. And I've heard it, that same story kind of told different ways. So I'm interested to hear it from your perspective. So him and Ray Capo go to this PWAC show that's like packed out.
Yeah. It was crazy because, you know, we were at a point in music. I mean, we were fresh out of high school. You know, we were like 19, 20, and we really started gaining some real traction in Long Island. And I think what made us unique is that we weren't like compartmentalized into either hardcore or metal. We really had a very unique sound that was a kind of a blend of both. And I know that sounds probably normal today, but back then you were either hardcore or you were metal. So as a result, I think people really attached themselves or connected with the authenticity of that. They hadn't really heard anything about like that, at least from Long Island. Long Island kind of leaned more into the emo, lighter, hardcore punk style. And obviously the New York sound was very, you know, street, more aggressive. And you know, we kind of had this blend of all of the bands that we loved. So we started to get a bit of traction and a decent following. A lot of that was by playing with metal bands at a club called the Roxy. I don't know if you remember the Roxy. We played with bands like Machine Head, and one of our big breaks was that we played with Korn right when they were blowing up. And you know, that for us was obviously a turning point. I think the PWAC show was a couple months after that. It was like our headlining show. And we had been regularly gaining traction where we were drawing, you know, 500 kids, and it was like 600 to 1,000 kids. We pulled up here and there was like 2,000 or 3,000 kids with a line around the block. By the way, PWAC, for those that don't know what PWAC is, it's a giant empty warehouse with a tiny stage and like a little sound system. No security, no guards, no nothing. It was just like 2,000 or 3,000 kids packed into this. So kids hanging out of windows trying to climb into the place. It was madness. You know, how he had seen us there. And Ray Capo had seen us play, I think a few months earlier than that, at a place called CC's in Scranton. We had gotten some following like in the Northeast by just playing out. And we opened for Shelter and he was like, I really love you guys. He had introduced Howie and they came down to that show. It was pretty quick. And at that time, you gotta remember, like now you can sign to a million different record labels as a metal band or a hardcore band or whatever that is. Back then, like if you didn't get discovered by Roadrunner, you didn't get discovered. Like that was it. So the fact that they were there was really incredible. But we liked the idea that it was Ray Capo's imprint on the label, you know, kind of added some element of hardcore to what is otherwise a pretty metal label, with the exception of maybe Madball at the time, and they had Dog Eat Dog and Life of Agony. So they were kind of like leaning in that direction, but most of the bands they had on there were straight metal.
How much of Ray Capo, or I guess you guys being fans of Ray Capo, did that play into you signing? Or was it more so like you just mentioned, it was that you had that hardcore authenticity with the metal, which kind of was what your band's identity was?
I mean, I think Ray Capo was more of a figurehead for the label than he was integral to any of the business, right? So like Howie was certainly more, once Howie Abrams got involved, the business kind of took over from there. Ray was definitely very instrumental in locating the talent. Like he was the person that was like, we opened for them. He was like, who the hell are you guys? And like, I've never, you know, this energy is incredible. I want you to meet. So he introduced us to all those people and, you know, he's the one that kind of heard us as a potential good fit for a Roadrunner, who might have otherwise been a little bit confused or perplexed, again, because we weren't really compartmentalized into either one way or the other. Ray Capo definitely was like, "This, you need to check these guys out."
Because no other releases happen with Roadrunner and Super Soul. It's just Vision of Disorder.
And actually, Howie left right after that as well. So we were kind of like, you know, it's it happened to us with Blood Simple too at Warner Brothers. Like, you know, our champions signed us. We were really embedded in the record label, and then all of a sudden they left. And we didn't really have a representative. So, that was definitely challenging and probably one of the disadvantages we had at that label.
Before you signed to Roadrunner, you put out the Still EP with the Juggalo homie / star of the New York hardcore documentary, Kevin Gill.
Yes.
How does that come about?
Oh, man. How did Kevin Gill find us? I think he found us off of New York's Hardest. We did a compilation that was just a bunch of hardcore bands, and we had two songs on it. And that got us a lot of attention. And, you know, Kevin Gill was just a scene guy. He didn't, you know, his record label had a few really cool bands on it, but it wasn't by any means, you know, massive distribution. I mean, we were literally all folding 7-inch inlays at his house before the release. Like, that's what we were doing. It was just crazy. The kids even know what those are anymore. I don't know. So, you know, he was a hustler and he knew good music, and, you know, we liked him, and he was, you know, for what we needed at the time, it was perfect. All we needed was, you know, we were in a great position where demand was pulling product from us. We just had to make music. And at that time, people would find it. They would find it everywhere. I would be getting letters from, I think I put my home address at the time on like the first demo, and I was getting like bags of letters from people in like Japan and Argentina, and like it's crazy. So you know this probably as well as I do, that the hardcore, the metal scene, but also like especially the hardcore scene, these the very devout followers, like they will find you, they know what's up. So it wasn't like pop music where you had to be distributed through all these channels to be heard. It's like they will find you if you are good and if you are resonating. So, you know, at the time we didn't really need someone to have these kind of hooks in all of the stores. We just needed someone that said, look, I have a little bit of I have some distribution, and here's a little bit of cash to go make a record. And that's all we needed at the time. And it worked really well. And we were, you know, it was a good partnership. And we, you know, I still think that from a sound perspective came out better than some of our records. That was just raw and just angry and aggressive.
It definitely has a different sound to it that even the songs that you kind of redo for the self-titled album. So on the self-titled record, which is 311 had their self-titled blue album. The Beatles had the white album. You guys have
the Green Drip.
The Green Drip. Yes, that is true. You know, the story of how that cover comes about is pretty casual. Like, you guys just flip through a book or something and find this picture, and you're like, oh, that looks like a disorderly vision. We're going to do that. The Still cover is this kind of like distorted woman emerging from the ocean. And then even the re-release has like, it's less distorted. It's kind of like a clearer focus of it. How did that cover get chosen?
Total plagiarism. We stole it from an art book. I don't know. Like, you can't do that today. I mean, look, again, we were like 19. We're like, oh, this is cool. No one will mind. So yeah, it was, I don't remember the name of the artist, but we took it. We took a lot of inspiration from art books. Like I remember even finding the Green Drip in like a photography or art book. We also took, For the Bleeders cover from an art book from a German artist, it's like a sketch artist. I don't know. Just there was something kind of just fitting about that cover. And I think that calming effect that photo had on us for Still worked really, really well. It's funny because Still that album cover came together really, really quickly. We were just like, that's something that's perfect. The Green Drip, surprisingly, took us a really long time. It took us months to come up with that.
I mean, it's iconic, you know, and what that means, I guess, is that, you know, it's easily recognizable. Nobody, if somebody saw that cover without the Vision of Disorder logo on it, they know that it's your album cover. So time well spent, I guess. But the one thing about that, too, which I guess plays into the disorderly vision of it, and going back to Chaos AD, that always weirds me out about that cover, is like the font and the the placement of it, it's like hard to read the name of the band. Was that deliberate or that just wasn't thought out through?
No, that was just bad. It's funny the things that like retroactively become like, you know, iconic or like what people find interesting because they're typically just mistakes or just bad.
So Jamie Locke is the producer slash engineer on this as well as Madball's first two albums for Roadrunner. I know that I've read prior that, and Matt Henderson has kind of said this too, that Jamie is like a great engineer, but maybe not the most hands-on producer as far as like kind of helping contribute to crafting the songs. And maybe that's what you were looking for, but what led to that choice being made?
Madball, straight up. We were like, the Madball guys did it. We were absolutely in love with Set It Off. That was one of our favorite records at the time. You know, we didn't have huge budgets and, you know, those, we had a couple options and that was the one we chose. But you know, you're right. Like good producers, like take the helm and they're like, they guide you. It's you as the band. And you know, we're not the kind of musicians that would just sit back and let someone else do it. But you know, having someone man the helm is probably a good thing, especially at our age, especially with like that being our first record. Yeah, we had a lot of pressures. There was a lot of, we'd already had a huge fan base. So it's not like we were starting from scratch. We felt like, okay, we have to live up to this. And I think as a result, we kind of got in our own way. He let the monkeys run the zoo, as they say. And so there's a lot of great things about that record, but I think sonically it didn't add up to where we wanted it to be.
Can you contrast that to working with Garth Richardson?
Garth took control in the way that you want a producer to take control, but not in a way to obfuscate what your true sound is. Like he really took your sound to the next level by finding what was special about us. Like, you know, at that time we wanted to be heavy. Like, you know, Tim and I were kind of like coming off of From Bliss to Devastation. We're like, you know, I feel like maybe that record wasn't as heavy there. Again, things about that record I really love, but there was definitely some sense that maybe the record was not as heavy as we wanted. So coming off of that, we definitely had, you know, this desire to do some very, very intense and heavy music. But in that world, as you probably remember in the early 2000s, there was still a lot of rock radio. So there were still these like pressures. If we're going to make a major label, do you need singles and do you need all this stuff? And that stuff was still kind of meandering in our thoughts. So, you know, most of the album was really heavy, but we had a couple of these songs where could have kind of went either way. And he was like, we are making a heavy record. And that was before we even chose him. And we were like, that's the producer we want. He just got it right away. He was just an amazing producer. He just trimmed all the fat and just made sure that like we were focused, and great vocal producer, really brought the best out of Tim. And sonically, the tones on that album are still, I think, to this day, stand the test of time.
Yeah, they're pummeling, right? Like you listen to that first Blood Simple record and it sounds like it could have come out today versus like you kind of alluded to the self-titled sounds of the time, like recording wise.
It's funny because I was playing that for some friends back in Long Island and they had all expected, you know, coming off of From Bliss to Devastation to kind of put out something very rock or maybe radio friendly. And we made our first single and it was Straight Hate. They heard the end, they're like, okay. All right, so we're not going for rock radio. That's good, which we weren't. We really just wanted to make music that we loved. I mean, there's a couple songs that lean into some more melodic stuff, but you know, we always had that piece of us.
Did you ever consider asking Matt Henderson to produce the record?
No, but we would never not consider Matt Henderson. He was great, man. That guy was like, he was like a surgeon with the guitar, man. Perfect in the way he played. So he would have definitely been on the table for sure.
I was just thinking about, you know, you're saying that you loved Set It Off. And I know that Jamie is
at the time. Yeah, it just didn't come up. I don't know why. In retrospect, that would have been amazing. Yes. I don't think that came up actually.
Of course, around this time, you're touring with a lot of hardcore bands, Earth Crisis. You kind of mentioned Dog Eat Dog, Shelter, of course. And then you did that run or not run that show with Korn, and you kind of have those elements of that kind of more modern rock that's happening at that time. I know that you're friends with and in a scene of hardcore bands, but listening to that album in retrospect, I would never be like, oh, these guys probably played with a lot of hardcore bands, you know, and it just doesn't have those same elements, probably because it's a little bit more progressive and ahead of its time. And the singing, I'm sure, is a big part of it too. So you do this tour, Ozzfest 97, after the record comes out, and it's kind of a mix of those things. You got rock bands like Drain STH, you've got super new metal bands like Coal Chamber. And do you find that touring with those bands kind of helped push you in the direction that things like Imprint and From Bliss to Devastation went into?
I think so. Well, Imprint was less influential and more about attitude, or I should say less influenced in terms of what we were feeling at the time. We were feeling aggressive. We were feeling a little bit frustrated, certainly as how the first record came out sonically. I say that, I know people love that record and there's things about that record that I love, but I just wish it came out a little heavier. You know, Imprint, we were in a different mindset. We were very insulated and like, yes, of course there were things that we were listening to that, you know, would come out in the music we were playing, but generally speaking, we were just pissed off. And we wrote that album in a room every day. We didn't have to go anywhere. We didn't have jobs. We just showed up every day and wrote songs. And we did that for like 8 months. And, you know, unlike the first album where there's songs from different eras of VOD, I say different eras, but like, you know, some off the, you know, the 7-inch, some off of this, some off of that. Like we wrote every one of those songs in a 6 to 8 month period. So they all had this kind of tonality and this aggression to them that were just off the charts. And, I think what we really started to develop in that sort of, you know, culmination of just being together a lot was this way of arranging songs that was unique, and this way of writing songs that was unique. You just a lot, like you just hear the ebb and flow of the band that was playing together in a way. I mean, the way we recorded that album was just live. We just plugged in a bunch of mics and played. Yes, we overdubbed some stuff, but that was a live recording. Think about that now. Bands don't even play together now. They don't even play together until they play their first show, for the most part. Now they write songs on a computer. They all record their instruments separately. We wrote and then recorded that album front to back, wrote it in 8 months, recorded it front to back in like 18 days or something, including the mix.
Not unlike Chaos AD and Roots.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you can feel it on those albums. They just, there's a cadence that you have when you're playing with your band members that you can't replicate. And even on the first album, when everything was separated, like you just didn't have that energy because you're playing things to what you think the tempo should be versus when you're playing together, you're going to go off of adrenaline and emotion, and it's just different. So yeah, I would say on Imprint, although there were some influences, I think Bliss and Devastation is where you really start to see the impact of outward influences coming to affect us and the music we were playing, and some good, some not so good.
Mike F, not you, other Mike. So Mike Fleischman, he's listed as, so there's on the credits of this record on my CD booklet, there's the four of you listed as the band. And then it says underneath that in a different font that Mike Fleischman does all the bass.
So Mike Fleischman, this is the first album, Mike Fleischman quit. So the mix was so pugilistic amongst the band members, and even Jamie Locke, like again, the monkeys were running the zoo. So rather than a cohesive stream of consciousness saying, this is how we want to sound and we can tweak from there, it was like, do that and you do this and hey, bring this up and bring that up. And he would just be like, again, we were like, you know, 20 years old, just like out of our minds, you know, just like stressed out and worried about the wrong things. And that's never how we had done music before. We just got in a room and played. So, you know, I think the pressures got to him and he quit. You know, we did a few tours with another bass player and it was not good. He's such an integral part of our sound. And, you know, we finally just made up and moved on. But it was crazy.
So it was really that contentious when you're recording this album. You guys are kind of butting heads, not really.
Yeah, a lot of weird stuff happened. It was like Tim lost his voice for the first time ever. I'd never heard that happen. We had to go re-record a lot of the vocal tracks. So Tim and I spent like a month in Boston at a different studio. Fleischman quit. You can almost sense that there was a lot of this, you know, contention. It doesn't feel cohesive in a lot of parts. And I could feel, you can feel in some level, the band just did not come together the way we have on other albums. And again, I still think the album is a worthy album. I think it just, if it had really hit the way we wanted it to, it would have been just over the, you know, through the roof.
You have a different perspective of it because you know what you wanted it to sound like and you know what you were coming to the album with. But me, listening to Still and then listening to Self-Titled, most of my friends think that Still is like the be-all, end-all because it's raw and it sounds more aggressive. And I can't disagree with that. But I think there's something about the polish to Self-Titled that actually makes it hit harder for me, that I actually like it more. Also, a big reason of that is just the songs that are on here. So I know you mentioned that it's got elements to it that are kind of like a patchwork of previous demos and 7 inches and stuff like that. But when you wrote Element, this life-changing song that redefines how my brain understands music at like 25 seconds when the screaming comes in and it actually goes into like the bar chord riff. When you're coming together with that, are you realizing, obviously you're not realizing, hey, Ryan in 25 years is going to be really geeking out about the song. But are you like, oh, this is, we're definitely going in the right direction with what we're doing? Because that song's a lot different than what came before it.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think that, you know, what made VOD unique was that there was never this contrived element to what we were doing. We never sat down and said, let's write a weird song with crazy, like, you know, arrangement. We just, you know, I wrote that song front to back on the riffs. I think Matt added one of the melodic parts, but like, that was pretty much written like that. Like we all think in weird time signatures and arrangements, and we were able to push and pull tempos in a way. So once you start to play them live with a drummer and you could really, you know, kind of like wind it up and wind it down, like to drop that breakdown or something, that song just came to life. And you know, it doesn't like repeat, that one part doesn't repeat into the end of the song. I didn't even realize that until like a couple of years ago, we were rehearsing for something. I'm like, this song doesn't even have a repeating part until the end. we just felt like our brains were all programmed like that. And we all worked together in a way that really moved that train of thought forward. And I think that's what made us a really progressive band, is that not only did we not try to do that, that just came organically and naturally, the ability to just write weird time signature or weird arrangements that worked well to the listener.
Yeah, that was one thing that I noticed about it, kind of just analyzing it versus just listening to it in preparation to talk to you about it, is that there's so many songs on here that are stuck in my head that, you know, I remember parts and things like that of, but there's very few like choruses on the whole album. You know what I mean? There's Through My Eyes has a repeating instrumental guitar riff that kind of starts the song and then it comes back in for the, you know, the. But it's not a lyrical repetition, is just that riff comes back in, so you remember subconsciously, I'm sure, like, oh yeah, that's right, I remember rocking out to this 2 minutes ago. So I think that that's an interesting part of it too, is that there is kind of all sorts of weird wacky stuff happening throughout it, but it's never to the point where it makes it like a chore or a challenge to listen to. It's very like natural the way it sounds.
Yeah, I think if you're going to write music that you know, is more linear versus repetitive, the pieces, it needs to evolve in a way that, you know, engages the listener. So, you know, the reason pop songs are easy to remember, because it's verse, chorus, bridge. There's this repetition to it, right? This is the hook. If you're going to move away from that template, it has to be building in a way that, you know, is going to have a moment, or, you know, just has these one or two pieces of a song that are just like so impactful that you still grab onto it, even though it's not this repetitive pop hook. And again, Tim was always good with like these just, you know, anthem-y type vocals, where there would be that point of the song where the whole floor would just jump up literally and just jump on top of us and just swallow us and like basically grab the mic and just take over. And we always just organically had one of those pieces of to the song. And now, you know, you hear it a lot in today's heavier bands, but again, it's built into a formula now. So like, it feels more contrived, whereas back then it's just what felt right. And, you know, we never ever once said, this is the part that all of the kids are going to grab the mic and do the thing. We just said, this is what feels good to us. And here's a tape of it.
Were there songs that you got to hear Tim's vocal approach for it before you guys went to record it? Because I would think the way that you're saying it kind of all kind of came together, that you're in the studio and you're first hearing, you know, something like, I don't know, on, well, I guess DTO is an older song, but you know, there's certain parts that are like almost like a mosh call, but they're built into a real lyric, so it doesn't sound like it's, you know, kind of being minimized to that.
We wouldn't hear them dissected, but we'd hear them in the studio. When I say in the studio, I mean we were in a rehearsal studio. We were playing together, so we would like, all right, let's play. Okay, let's go through DTO. Let's go through Beneath the Green. We'd all just play it together. So that was like our rehearsal. It's not like we would just have, you know, guitars, you know, and then once we're in the recording studio, then Tim would come in and lay vocals down. That did happen here and there. That happened, you know, later on when we were doing tracks and we only had music done, and he would just go in and blast out vocals in the studio. But typically we'd have the song completely written. So we knew what he was doing was pretty sick. We didn't know what the hell he was saying. So that we didn't, in many cases, didn't discover that until, you know, recordings, or, you know, we actually opened the album sleeve and we're like, oh, that's what he's saying. I don't even think he knew what he was saying. No, I'm kidding. He was like a very intentional lyricist. He was great. But there were some parts that he would just be making noises and then like they would develop into something. But, you know, yeah, like and also we would play so many shows that like we perform songs live before they weren't on the albums. Like, you know, so up until Imprint, we were playing shows and playing songs live. So it's not like we would know the reactions to these songs before they were getting put on any sort of recording.
DTO specifically sounds like it's kind of designed for people to beat the hell out of each other with the lyrics. Like, I mean, it opens up with the get up. And then there's also later like, what's up? You know, this is like, it seems very deliberate.
It wasn't. It's hard to say that now but in like, it's really important to note that this was in like, what, 93 or 4? That, it didn't exist. There was no reference to say like, there's going to be this crazy hardcore show with people on top, jumping on top of you. Like, it just didn't exist. But yes, there were hardcore shows. Yes, they were fun. But we started playing at like, small divey clubs like called the Right Track Inn in Long Island, and like, you know, Hammerheads in Long Island, and like Bond Street and Lower East Side of Manhattan. And, you know, it didn't really have that element. It didn't exist. I mean, it did obviously for bands like Agnostic Front maybe, but in our world, we didn't really see it. We just, again, we're really writing music that spoke to us. What happened with us where these scenes kind of all came together, it was not just us alone, but there was this elevation of that scene that happened throughout those 90s that was really amazing. Nothing was intentional in terms of what the effect live would be. It was just about writing cool songs.
Yeah, that's the biggest aspect, I think, of Vision of Disorder in general when I'm talking to people about it, is by the time I found out about VOD, Imprint is already out. In fact, From Bliss to Devastation might have been about to come out. And the first time I saw you was with Scrape. All right. So by this point, all these things have already homogenized in a good way. You know, to me, when I'm seeing VOD or Scrape, it's the same, you know, these newer bands with a U, they're all kind of the same thing in a way that I'm not separating them. I'm not like, oh, this is a hardcore band or this is whatever. Yeah. So when I go back and listen to this, you know, it has all these elements that became bigger things and more commonplace. Like a lot of the rhythms on here, I think are very, you know, inspirational to other nu metal bands. I mean, there's even exact like passages on here that sound like specific songs by bands that I like. Like there's a part in Zone Zero that sounds exactly like the verses of a Taproot song.
Yeah.
the title track on Seven Dust's Home has like parts that sound like VOD. Not to say that they are deliberately being like, oh, we're going to copy this VOD part, but
I love the influence stuff. I always felt like VOD was a band that influenced a lot of bands, right? Like we didn't reach the final consumer as deeply as maybe some of the bands after us did that, you know, were more commercially successful, but we definitely influenced a lot of bands. We were a band's band. Funny enough, you mentioned Scrape, you know, I don't know if you know the trivia, that's where we met Will Hunt, who ultimately became the Blood Simple drummer.
Oh, I did not know that.
That tour that you just mentioned was where we met Will Hunt.
Currently of Evanescence fame.
So we hit it off, and then he found out we were doing a new project. At the time, it was a side project, and he was like, I want to be in the band. He had commitments to Evanescence, so we had kind of like missed each other. But by the second record, he was in the band.
Oh, wow. That is actually really cool.
Yep. He's still a bro.
Because, you know, two songs in particular that stick out on here are Liberation, which has my favorite guitar parts out of any song on the album, which I feel like that song doesn't get as much love as it should, probably because it's on the same album as Element, so it's not even fair. But it has like that kind of like 80s like Pantera riff halfway through it, you know what I'm talking about?
And
then it ends with that really, you know, nu metal single note riff.
Yeah, that had a lot of good melody on, like there was some good melodic parts on that song. Wow, I haven't thought of that song at all. I wrote that one right before we finished the first record. That was one of the last songs we wrote for the first record. We were in a rehearsal studio. That was one of the last ones that came up. So we had never played that live. There's like most of the songs on that album had been tried and true, played them live, but there's probably maybe four or five songs that we had just written before the album came out. And that one was one of them.
Viola or Viola, spelled in the liner notes as Vio, capital L-A. Is this based on a person or a place?
Person. Henry Lee Lucas's mother. Look it up.
Okay. I will go do some reading.
He's a serial killer. There's a lot of stuff that we'll ask Tim. This is my Tim impression. But yeah, you know, it's just a thing that I had. Don't worry about it. So we're like, all right, Tim.
Tim's on The Sopranos.
He is like, you know, he's got a raspy voice.
So aside from just the general mix of it, is there anything specific on when you listen back to this album that you would have done differently as far as maybe like an arrangement or something like that?
Well, look, the songs are great. I would have probably put on Choke, probably. I would have probably made sure we played together because we are, again, one of our superpowers as a band. And back then this wasn't a big deal, but now they don't do it. It's like, we all played together. We played the songs, we rehearsed the songs, right? They weren't verse, chorus. You had to like write them and map them out and you had to memorize them. So the idea that these tempos would be all over the grid was what made us unique to listen to, because it just went with what you were feeling. It wasn't like this grid. And, you know, we didn't do that on that record. So I wish we had. We had done that on all the other records since. And, the drum tracks were clicked to the natural tones or tempos. So we would like, after that, we would play the songs live. Then we would map out the tempos and repeat them based off of all of the, you know, strange tempo changes and inflections that we had as a band. So we were able to just so we can have some continuity if we wanted to repeat things. But like, it was all based off of that, the ebb and flow of the live playing.
Yeah, that's my thing that I would change about it is I would have if you had Choke on here, which I know you do for the Bleeders, but one of the coolest things a band can do is say their own name in a song. So the fact
that agreed.
That being left out is a bit, and you still played it the whole time. I mean, it wasn't like you ever dropped it from a set.
It's an anthem. It's an anthem. I don't know what the hell we were thinking.
You mentioned that you met Will on this tour with Scrape. Did you have any kind of lifelong friendships that were started on Ozfest? I mean, I got to imagine there's crazy things that happened on there.
Oh, my God. You know, we met Rob Flynn and the Machine Head guys on Ozfest, and they were really great to us. They were very gracious, and, you know, they were on the main stage, and they would come over regularly. Rob Flynn was always a big fan of Tim's, like, vocally. I think they just really kind of connected, and he saw a lot of, even when we opened with For Them in Long Island before we even got signed, and they were like, who are you guys? And he was just very enthralled with Tim's vocal style. You know, again, no one was doing that back then, really. A little bit, but not with the dichotomy that Tim was able to do, where you had this like aggressive screamer and then these really beautiful singing parts. Like, it just didn't happen back then. So I think he was just very enthralled with what, you know, we were doing as a band. He liked hardcore. So when we did Ozfest with them, they were just really gracious to us and fantastic. You know, we got to meet the guys from Pantera, who incredible dudes, really, really nice, very open arms, just wanted to drink and party and have fun. And Dimebag was like the nicest guy you could ever meet, with no snobbery whatsoever. Like the biggest band on the planet. It was like, hey man, come have a drink. You know, great, really, really, really great people. And obviously Tim and Phil connected there. Phil did a lot of side dates with us. We had these, like, you know, with Ozfest, you don't play every day. It's every like 3 or 4 shows a week. So in between those dates, you would do off dates. So some of the bands from the tour would get together a roster. So a lot of the off shows were Neurosis and us. And he was friends with the Neurosis guys, so he would just be with us on the off dates. So we would be like, you know, in like a small town in Alabama, and it would be us and Neurosis and Phil and Selma like hanging out in the cafe, like just waiting to play. It was surreal. And you know, he and Tim became friendly, and ultimately he ended up singing on Imprint as a result of that, which was such a great experience. Yeah, Ozfest was incredible, man. It was like a dream come true. Again, back then in 97, you really kind of had to choose what side of the fence you were on. There was hardcore and metal. Now there's metalcore. There was no metalcore back then. So like, I don't think we did well, don't get me wrong, but I think a lot of people didn't know, again, how to compartmentalize us. So we had our fans and we were acquiring new fans, but not at the rate that Cold Chamber was acquiring new fans. Like they were, this is our thing. You know, we wear fishnets and we're on the radio, and like, you know, everyone just showed up wearing fishnets and listened to the radio. And like, that's like, we just didn't have that sort of mass appeal. We were proggy and weird, and people were like, I've never heard this before. So,
well, style wise, you guys were pretty Ozfest 97 though, right? With the basketball jerseys yeah, and yes. Chain wallets.
I had some chain wallets. I might have some bleach hair. Shit happens.
No, I'm saying that with respect and admiration. Yeah.
Apparently Jankos are back in style though, and I was rocking a hell lot of those on that tour.
Well, let me tell you something about Jankos. This is important that people seem to forget, but maybe you'll remember. They were expensive as hell. I couldn't get Jankos when I was younger. They were like $120 jeans, and this is in the 90s. So that's like $200 jeans now. I had to get what was called Lee Pipes, which were like the JCPenney off brand.
That's, don't ever tell anyone that ever.
I'm telling the world right now, letting them know.
Oh man. Only thing worse than Jankos are ripoff Jankos. Oh man.
I had one pair of Jankos, and it was because my neighbor was going to throw them away because he was rich. He was getting a new pair. They were called Flameheads. I remember. I don't think they were my size, but you know, back then nothing you wore was your size.
Oh, completely not. That's hysterical, man. I, you know, like we were with Concrete Management, who managed Pantera, and we were on the Ozfest and doing a bunch of stuff. So we would just get boxes of Adidas and like all these different clothes. I think we got Jankos actually.
Judge none, choose one jeans you were endorsed by is what you're saying?
We got some really good endorsements back then, I will say.
Jankos question. But I'll spare you. I will ask.
I can talk Jankos all day, man. I'm okay.
The way I found out about VOD was I was really into Fear Factory and Machine Head. And I had a friend who, and Fear Factory, they also were one of the few bands that were kind of doing that clean singing and the heavy music. So
yeah.
I don't know if you guys bonded over that or were rivals on Ozfest because of it. So this guy is like, you got to hear this band, Vision of Disorder. Phil Anselmo's on a song and the singer, Tim, blew out his eye vessel trying to scream as hard as Phil Anselmo. Did that really happen?
No.
So my whole VOD legacy is a lie?
No, that didn't happen. As a matter of fact, I wasn't there in the studio, but if you hear Tim tell the story, Tim was coming off of 8 months of rehearsals with us day after day after day. Phil was not. So when Phil got in the studio, Tim heard him do a couple, he went first to record and he did his first couple tracks and Tim was like, not sound good. And then he said he warmed up and he was like, okay, thank God. And Tim went in and like blasted it out in like 2 seconds. And Phil apparently said, holy shit, that was amazing. Like he was done in 2 takes, Tim. And Phil took him a while. So no, but I like your legacy. I think that's hysterical.
Well, yeah, if you could just perpetuate the story I just told you instead.
I wasn't there for either of them. So any of them could be true. They're all alternate realities as far as I'm concerned. But I know Tim was very dialed in with his voice at that time because we were literally rehearsing every day. He flew down from the rehearsal studio right to Phil's house, spent 2 days with him and came back. So like he was on fire. And Phil was doing nothing. No, I don't say nothing at the time, but he was in between tours. So he was not singing.
Were you involved in Skull Crusher at all?
I was not. That was some of our friends, though. Like, you know, it's a group of friends from Long Island. I was not involved in Skull Crusher. That was actually, they had some really good songs, though. I always kind of wanted to hear that. Another little piece of trivia. I quasi started a record label. I tried to start a record label. And Skull Crusher was going to be one of the first bands we did like an EP with. It was Skull Crusher and another band that was like local from the area. I really wanted to be in the record business at the time. Thank God I didn't go there.
I was going to say, then you experienced it for a little while and you're like, oh, you know what? Maybe not.
Yeah, I decided to go into something way more sustainable. I own restaurants in Brooklyn. That was a much better idea.
What is your fondest memory of making this album? I know you have a lot of, I don't want to say regrets, but things you look back on and you're like, oh, we could have done that differently. But what do you look back on fondly about it other than just the legacy it may have?
We recorded at this beautiful studio in Massachusetts. It was so nice and we were in nature. So the first part of recording that album was really blissful and really amazing. Things started to kind of fall apart after that. But being away as a musician together with your bandmates was a phenomenal experience. And I, you know, any band, I hope they get the opportunities to do that these days.
Being a band, that era of Vision of Disorder from between self-titled and Imprint.
Oh, those shows are, being able to travel the world, play with such amazing bands like Sick of It All and Machine Head and some of the people, the friends we made, like being able to play those shows live, I still feel like there's nothing like it on the planet in terms of any sort of adrenaline rush. I've jumped out of airplanes, I rock climb. All of that is like chasing that adrenaline rush that you get when you play live. You cannot replicate it. And that was a special time for that.
Thanks to Mike Kennedy for the knowledge and the riffs, but maybe most of all, that everyone my whole life who tried to tell me VOD didn't have new credentials can shut their mouths and widen their pant legs because they were sponsored by JNCO. And if you want to help the show go from Lee Pipes to the real deal, please go on Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review, share this on your social media. You won't get shadow banned. In fact, you'll get promoted. And follow the show on Instagram at MeepMeepPod. There's pictures. Thanks for hanging out. We'll talk next week. In the meantime, I'm Ryan Rainbow. This is Meep Meep, and yes, that's the best I could come up with. Bye!